Welcome to episode 168 of Speaking of Mysteries. I'm Nancy Clare, and Cara Black, whose Murder in Bel-Air, the 19th Emmy LeDuc mystery in 20 years, has just been published. For our interview, Cara and I met in a cafe just up the street from Chevalier Books, an independent bookstore on Larchmont Avenue in L.A., where she had spoken about and signed the book for a full house of Emmy LeDuc fans. I tell you all this not necessarily to make you envious, but to explain the background noise. Here's Cara Black.
We're at the Café Parisien on Larchmont, or as they say in L.A., Larchmont. After a soirée, a book soirée at Chevalier's, and Nancy is going to have the, what are you having?
I'm going to have the chicken paillard and pommes frites.
I'm going to have a crepe.
And we're going to talk about Cara Black's most recent book, Murder in Bel-Air, which is your 19th Emmy LeDuc mystery and the 20th anniversary of Emmy. So my first question is, I would think that the two of you have learned a lot from each other, and I'm wondering what you've learned from Emmy.
I have learned that that Italian scooters are always temperamental. They should be left in the garage. I think I've learned her observational skills are something that I would like to have, and because when I write the story, of course, I'm writing it, and then I realize I need to be writing as a detective would. You know, that's what she does. She's acute. She has acute observations.
Each of your books is arrondissement specific. Some mysteries take place in the more famous arrondissement, and others, like Bel-Air, which is in the 12th, are a little bit more off the beaten track. And I was wondering, what process do you go through to make each area compelling? What do you look for when you're looking for the location of your next mystery, other than it's in an arrondissement you have not put a mystery in before?
Right. I'm looking for what makes it unique, you know, and every part of Paris has its own history, even though sometimes it looks, you know, residential, it looks very quiet, but like everywhere in Paris, it always has a history. It's just about digging a bit deeper. And I want to know, I mean, of course, there's always cafes and tabacs and metro stops, but what, you know, Paris is a collection of villages, and each king would just, you know, build a wall and then tax the, you know, people coming from outside the wall, and then the next king would knock the wall down and make it bigger until we have what is today 20 arrondissements. And you know they're going to be expanding, that Paris is expanding. So what is it, you know, what was the old village there? What was special there? What, you know, what makes it, what gives it that flavor? And that's what I'm always looking for. What makes it special? You know, the Parisians always say, like, if they're talking about the 16th arrondissement, the very chichi residential area, you know, it's like, oh, he's from the 16th, which implies, you know, maybe someone aristocratic, very well off, who wants to live in kind of a very quiet, you know, wealthy neighborhood. So even the Parisians refer to people from these different arrondissements as, you know, oh, he's from, you know, he's from the dead zone, which they call the 15th, and, you know, because it's so residential. So there's the Parisians also refer to the, you know, areas, you know, and you're identified by that. I once saw this Parisian map where they had, like, some of the arrondissements, they had someone sleeping, you know, it's a snooze place. And it's like, no, it's not, but because I think there's history everywhere. I don't know. Does that answer your question?
It does answer my question, but at the book signing, we've just come from Cara's book signing at Chevalier's Books, you talked specifically about the 12th, and you mentioned this one street, and I'd love you to tell the story of that remarkably narrow street in the 12th.
It's so I was looking at a map of the 12th. I always do before I go, and I was looking for very small streets because I always think that, you know, that shows some history. Why is it still a small street? So I found this street called Sentier des Miliciers, and I went there, and it literally, it's like a path, but they call it a street. And it's 2 feet by 9 inches wide. And I thought, how would you even get a cart down here? You know, I mean, really? And how would you even bring furniture through here? Or, you know, milk or horses? I don't know. And I realized this was from when it was countryside. It's really like a village. And there's a house on the corner that was built in the style of like a Brittany farmhouse with timbers on the outside, or actually Normandy farmhouse, you know, those timbers and the stucco. And of course I wanted to set, you know, a scene in that house because I couldn't believe this path. It felt like, you know, it was from medieval times, and I'm sure it is.
So Murder in Bel Air is set in 1999. And for me, 1999 is like yesterday. But I would think that some of your readers, maybe many of your readers, your Amy LeDuc series could be thought of as historical because it's almost 20 years ago. And that made me go, yikes, oh my gosh. What do you do to put yourself in the 1999 frame of mind, you know, get yourself into that vibe?
Sure. Well, it is 20 years. I've been, you know, 20 years of Amy LeDuc, a book birthday. But I was, you know, in 1999, I was in Paris. I mean, I was in Paris a lot in the 90s. I remember it. I had a young child. I would take him. I was also staying in Bel Air with him when he was about 6 years old. And I remember trying to keep him, you know, occupied and show him places in this area. And as a, you know, going to the park with a child, you get to meet Parisians, and you meet other Parisian parents. And I love that because they don't need language in the sandbox, you know, they can play. And so I remembered that feeling, and I don't know, I don't find it hard to go back to that time at all. I was there a lot, and, you know, it was pre-Google, we had routers, do you remember routers, we had dial-up. I mean, I can cast my mind back to that, not that long ago.
And you mentioned it was also pre-Euro.
Yeah.
People were buying and selling in francs.
Yeah, you go to the market, 5 francs, 10 francs, and so they were smoking in the cafes, and, you know, it was probably a bit slower, you know. So, I mean, we'd go into the cafe near Madame Gerbault's house where we were staying, and we would talk to them, oh, you're the Americans who are staying in our house. And we, you know, it was very, there's very much a neighborhood feeling, a little, you know. Once they see you and they know who you are, they will talk to you. And especially with my son, with a child, it's so easy to get to relate to Parisians on another level as parents.
And, of course, you're fluent in French. I've heard you speak, so.
I get by.
Even in Paris, I think you probably more than get by.
Well, the cops only speak to me in French, and they don't speak the French I learned in school, let's say.
Frequently to always, your books weave in French history. Murder in the Marais, which was your first Amy LeDuc, brought in World War II. Other of your books have integrated World War II. This one is a little different. In the case of Murder in Bel Air, it's France's involvement in Africa, and specifically the Ivory Coast or Côte d'Ivoire, that is what's going on there that is part of this book. And I was wondering, what about this period in France's colonial past attracted you, wanted you to do a story and involved it?
Well, my friend Florence, a journalist, went to live in the Côte d'Ivoire, and it was at that time when, in 1999, when they were having a coup was brewing, and they actually had a coup d'etat in Christmas Day 1999. So everything she was telling me, you know, about how it was the jewel of the former French African colony, how it was very stable politically. Everyone spoke, oh, the Côte d'Ivoire, it's like a, you know, a pinnacle of African stability. Africa will be fine, when it really, you know, was not that rosy a picture. And I read about a man who became, he was in De Gaulle's African Bureau when France had colonies, and he was a good friend of De Gaulle's, and he literally ran behind closed doors the colonies in French Africa, and he knew all the dictators. He went to their children's weddings or baptisms. He knew everyone. He was the tonton, you know, like the uncle, and he would make things happen. They trusted him. He would help them. They would help them, and France was very much, you know, in control of business and trade. And so, you know, he was behind the scenes, even after De Gaulle. With every French president, he was always there. He didn't have a formal office, but he ran everything.
You have a character in your book that is similar to this. And I think a lot of people forget that France was a huge colonial power.
Yes.
In the 19th century. And they controlled Morocco, they controlled Algeria, the Ivory Coast. They had their fingers in a lot of African pies.
Mm-hmm.
And I just found it really fascinating because, of course, this book takes place in October 1999, so it's leading up to the coup.
Yeah.
And many of the characters that are in Paris that Emmy is trying to find out what they're up to are going to probably be involved in a few months.
Yeah.
I would guess. No spoilers, though. No spoilers.
No spoilers. No spoilers.
And then there's, you know, Sydney, Emmy's mother, who also Chloe's grandmother, and a former or maybe current CIA asset. When she wasn't part of her life, Emmy missed her mother. And now that she is part of her life, I think maybe Sydney drives Emmy crazy.
Yeah. You have a very, Emmy doesn't, she's always wished for her mother to be around, but then she thinks of that Chinese saying, be careful what you wish for, because the woman is not necessarily, has ever been a mother, and she knows her limitations. And whether Sydney has kept her distance because of the danger to Aimee, or, you know, maybe it's because she couldn't be the proper mother, we don't know. But so they're trying to make some kind of bridge, and Aimee's like, are we fighting? I mean, she can't believe that.
It's a rocky bridge.
Yeah.
And it's a difficult. The book starts, it's not a spoiler to say that the book starts when Sydney doesn't show up to pick up Chloe from her daycare.
Yeah.
And Emmy has to leave a business event and rush across town. Of course, it then plunges her into this mystery. We wouldn't have the book if Sydney hadn't done that. But to anyone who's been a parent, you can sort of understand this is absolutely crazy.
Mm-hmm. Well, haven't you ever been somewhere and there's a phone call and it's like, Mommy, you know, school's, haven't you picked, and you're like, what? This happened to me. I was in Philadelphia and the school called at 6 o'clock and said, you need to pick up your son from school. I said, what? I'm in Philadelphia. What are you talking about? No, it's, you know, and my husband hadn't picked him up, and I'm like, oh my God, what can I do? I mean, it's the worst nightmare. What do you do? And of course, then my husband came 10 minutes later. But it's, you know, as a parent, you're always on call. I mean, you know, you have to go.
And that's something that I think that Emmy is learning. She's a single mother, although the father of Chloe is in and out of the picture.
The biological father.
Bio dad, as I like to call him. And he's an interesting character, and Emmy has conflicting feelings about him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think for reasons of full disclosure, I have to mention that there's a character in Murder in Bel-Air named after me, Nancy Clare. And this is a huge honor for which I'm humbled and grateful. But it got me to thinking about the naming of characters and just like the writing process, you know, these queries about the dreaded outline or pants or, that every writer gets. The naming of characters is really interesting. And when we talked previously, you talked a little bit about this, and you have challenges naming characters in a book that takes place in the latter part of the 20th century in France. And I would love for you to describe how difficult it could be and how challenging it could be with characters and how many Jean-Louis you think could be in a book.
True, yeah. Well, there is something Elmore Leonard said once, that he can't write the character until he has their name. You know, once he has their name, then he has them. And but for me, because in France, until I can't remember the date, you could only use approved names in France to name your child, and they were usually saints' names. And so, you know, there's only so many for men. You know, there's Jean, Paul, and then Francois, Lucien, and then you do all the permutations, Paul Louis, and, you know,
Louis-Paul.
And I can't have too many because I have Jean, I have Claude, her grandfather, and her father Jean-Claude, and then there's... So I use a lot of last names, actually, for men because it's just easier because I can't have so many Pauls in every book, or I had a Paul 2 books ago. So, but then when this was lifted, when they could use other names, a lot of the names were... There was a time when there were a lot of Jennifer, you know, and there was Hilary. So, you know, they were from different times. And then there's, I was talking about when Dallas, the TV show Dallas, was in France and was dubbed. And I heard it one time walking by this window in this village. And the man would say, Suellen, no, c'est interdit, no, Suellen. So, and then there was a whole group of girls named Sue Ellen in France. So, you know when they were born, it was when Dallas was on. So, my friend says, you have to be careful. If you use old-fashioned names, like Nanette, you get, you know, those are definitely, like she said, those are my grandmother's, grandparents' names. So, you have to be careful generationally, which, you know, is true, is really true.
And a number of writers had different approaches. Naomi Hirahara said that she could only name characters after people she liked.
Even the villains?
Even the villains, because she couldn't let any negative vibes into her book. And Olin Steinhauer, who's written books and written books that have been located in France, says sometimes he puts in brackets like name one, name two, because he does it backwards. He looks at the character and then finds a name. So to me, this is fascinating because the characters are like our Virgil. They're taking us through the story.
But, you know, the book before Murder in Saint-Germain, I had a character, and I was taking notes in a famous, they have them in New York now. It's Eric Kaiser Boulangerie. There's many in
Paris. Oh, yeah, I've seen them
right
in New York.
Yeah, and then they have them in New York now. So while I was in there taking notes and everything for the character, I was like, okay, I just put Eric Kaiser because I was in the boulangerie. So as I was writing and through the whole manuscript, it was Eric Kaiser. And then when I sent it to my editor, she goes, there is actually an Eric Kaiser Boulangerie below my publisher, Soho Press at Union Square. She said, do you mean that one? I went, oh, my God, I used it. I never changed it. So I just changed the Eric to a C-H or something. But for me, he was Eric Kaiser. I mean, because I couldn't change it after the whole book. So I just changed that part.
Because characters... Let me ask you a question then about your first book, Murder in the Marais. When you came up with this character of Amy Leduc, how did that happen? Was it like she sprung from your forehead, like Athena?
No, But regarding her name, I was thinking, what name? Her mother was American, right? Her father was a French policeman. So what name would they pick? Aimee? And it could be Amy, right? Which she calls her Amy, the American. So I thought that would be easy. And it's a beautiful name, like loved one in French. So I thought that was perfect. And Le Duc, I mean, there is a real detective agency called Duluc Detective. So originally I called her that, and then for legal reasons we couldn't, so we just switched the name to Le Duc. But everyone knows that that's the inspiration. And Amy was always half American, half French, you know, because I couldn't write as a Frenchman. But I could, you know, having learned French in school, I was educated by French nuns, and there was this, my father was a Francophile, so my uncle had lived in Paris, you know, after World War II on the GI Bill and studied art and drank a lot of red wine and talked about it. So there's this strange Francophilia in our family, and when I went there, I felt very familiar, but I was always an outsider. I still am, and that's okay, because I'm not, you know, it's good to be an outsider when you're writing about a place. You know, I notice things that, you know, you wouldn't if you lived there, right? So
I think, like you talked about at the beginning of our discussion, honing those observational skills, and sometimes it's easier to do that as an outsider. Things that people take for granted, the narrow street, the house that's built like a chateau in Normandy, people don't see that anymore.
Yeah, and you know,
you do.
George Simenon, right, who wrote the Inspector Maigret series, wrote many in French, but he was Belgian, okay? And when he came to Paris, I can always see, I mean, he has acute observational skills, and he writes about things, and I think, yeah, I mean, I always thought he was French until I realized, but he sees it different. He grew up in a village in Belgium, right? So you come to Paris, you know, the big city. Yeah. And I think that informs your writing, and I think that's good, you know.
And I overheard you talking to the bookseller at Chevalier, and so I wanted to ask you what's next for Amy, but you've actually got something else before your next Amy Le Duc, and I was wondering, do you want to talk about that? Is it finished? Have you pressed the send button yet?
Yes, I pressed the send button to my editor, who is on her own book tour right now. My editor, Juliette Grams, has written this wonderful book, The 7 or 8 Deaths of Stella Fortuna. And, yeah.
God, that's your editor?
That's Julia.
Oh, my gosh.
And it's not a mystery, but it's, yeah, so she's on book tour right now, and so she's trying to get more edits back to me as she's on book tour, and she has a 6-month-old, so it's a challenge.
Multitasking.
Yes.
Yeah. But she's a woman. She can do it.
She can do it. So tentatively titled 3 Hours in Paris, may change, and we're looking at March 2020 to come out. It's a standalone historical thriller, and then the next day May would be 2021.
In which case, are we going to be in the year 2000, or are we still going to be at the end of 1999?
Nancy, I haven't written it yet. I've just started, so I can't tell you. I don't know.
Gives us something to look forward to. Thanks again, Cara, for talking to us, and I can't wait to meet in another cafe to talk about 3 Hours in Paris or whatever the title ends up being.
Thank you.